time for Licking on Lending.
Welcome, everybody. Good to have you with us.
Welcome to Licking on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update providing up-to-the-minute information on interest rates, loan programs, and hot industry news, all related to the mortgage industry. Brought to you by Transformational Mortgage Solutions. To participate in today's program, our guest call-in line is 646-716-4972. And now here's your host of Licking on Lending, David Licking.
Let's begin.
Listeners, I am so honored to have Greg Keith, Senior Vice President and Chief Risk Officer for Ginnie Mae. Welcome to the microphone. Appreciate you taking time, Greg, to be here with us.
Thank you for having me.
It's an honor. Now, let's get to the longevity. You've been there 9 years. Are you getting to be one of the more senior individuals there?
Well, in the senior management team, I am certainly one of the more long-tenured employees. But we have employees that go back to the mid-1980s that are still part of our staff.
Oh, wow.
We certainly have our share of folks that have dedicated their careers to making sure Americans can get access to affordable housing.
Well, you've got a stellar resume, and folks, I encourage you to go check out his resume on LinkedIn. We'll put a link to it. But you are also at Fannie Mae. You are a director there, as well as First Union. You were at KPMG. And also a financial analyst, Great American Bank. You got a great resume. Let's let our listeners just get to know you a little bit, some of your background that's relevant to what we're going to be talking about today.
Sure. You know, I started in this business while I was still in college. I worked at a San Diego-based SNL. Gave me my first opportunity to have a seat for the SNL crisis. From there, I went to work for John Robbins at American Residential Mortgage there in La Jolla.
Right.
Which was one of my favorite jobs I've ever had in my lifetime. From there, as you mentioned, KPMG, where I consulted for some of the largest mortgage companies in the country, including GE, First Nationwide, and in the subprime space, Ames Home Loan. Again, from there, went to First Union, and I got my second crisis. I got exposure to the Russian flu and had to help First Union navigate its way out of some of those challenges. From there to Fannie Mae was, as you pointed out, where I enjoyed the fun of the Great Recession and the crisis, which brings us up to today, where we are, you know, facing a new challenge to the industry.
Well, this is certainly bringing about some changes in how we look at housing finance, and certainly as a lender, and that's really why I wanted to get you on and have you give our listeners an update. Because what I'm experiencing, which is I'm sure what you're experiencing, is a surge of interest to get approved with Ginnie Mae. And so, folks, what we're doing is we're going to get into the various things that we look at as a consulting firm, the requirements that Ginnie Mae specifically looks for. We have the minimum requirements. And I think one of the great analogies you've used over the numerous times we've talked, Greg, is you talk about getting into college. And I think one of the examples you had is pick one of the Ivy League schools. There are the minimum requirements, but how many people get admitted meeting the minimum requirements? Talk about that, if you would. Set the proper expectation for everybody.
Sure. The Ginnie Mae program is a highly prescribed program. So you need to really be very tight in how you manage your business relative to the handbooks of the insuring agencies, as well as managing to our mortgage-backed securities guide. It can be cash-intensive to originate and maintain the servicing asset. And lastly, I think a lot of folks forget that issuers retain some level of credit risk.
Right.
So given that the business is complex and can be challenging, you know, our view of what a successful issuer would look like includes a really strong corporate and staff resume that reflects their ability to manage the interest rate risk and credit risk inherent within the business, expertise in managing a servicing asset that is very dynamic and perhaps labor-intensive, as well as experience complying with a highly prescribed program. The next thing that we care about is, you know, do they have a thoughtful business plan, an ability to achieve scale, an ability to ensure that they have some diversity in their revenue streams? A good example of that is manifesting itself today. Several issuers have applied to our program with the desire to be a PIT only. PIT is our co-issuance program. And what we see is that PIT acquirers have dried up at the moment, leaving those issuers with a challenge of finding liquidity for their MBS. The next thing that we care about, of course, is the financial wherewithal. It's not enough to say, well, we meet the minimum. What we want to see is that they have a history of managing through multiple cycles, that they have the cash needed to originate loans as well as manage the interest rate risk and the hedges associated with those, the cash that they might need to make advances when the loans are delinquent or alternatively where there's forbearance in place. And lastly, we like to see that there's been a significant investment in infrastructure. You know, have they purchased or installed technology that increases their level of controls, increases their level of efficiency? Are they governed by sound, you know, policies and procedures? And do they have, you know, what we would consider to be a robust, you know, kind of governance structure? All of those allow us to get the level of comfort that when we put the government's guarantee, the unconditional, you know, stamp of approval from the U.S. government, that we can feel that that's an appropriate risk for the government to be taking.
Let's dive into a couple of those. One, first of all, everyone talks about net worth, tangible net worth, cash net worth. Is there a relationship between cash and volume? There's no way that you can really, once someone's approved, they can start originating more than their cash position can handle. What would you say to those that want to get into the program and say, no, I guarantee I won't originate more than what our cash position would allow?
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think is important. The net worth and liquidity requirements, to a large degree, serve as a good bill of health that you have been able to aggregate some capital and accrete a level of liquidity. But certainly, it doesn't necessarily mean that you are a healthy organization. And one of the things we do see from time to time is some issuers will over-risk themselves relative to their financial strength. And that's really a challenge. You know, again, folks shouldn't think of these requirements as a good seal of approval. Meeting the minimums, whether as an applicant or over the longer term once they become an issuer, is really not the goal. The goal is not to get a C. The goal is to try to get an A.
Yeah, great way to put it. Greg, a lot of folks say, okay, there's a lot to applying. Why don't I just go out and buy a company? And there's certainly enough companies out there that are for sale. We're going to talk about this later in the interview, but I know there's something like 65 approved entities that are not even really participating. They're approved, but they're not really active. And someone might say, well, I want to go pick up one of those companies and I'll get them active. Is there a difference in applying versus acquiring, buying a company? And how does Ginnie Mae look at that?
Well, the answer is they look very similar. The change of control process includes, you know, a lot of the same things that we talked about relative to the de novo issuer approval. We're very focused on what the combined corporate and staff resume will look like once the change of control has occurred, understand their business plan, understand, you know, the aggregate financial capability of the combined organization. And so really, a potential acquirer shouldn't think of this as a way to use, a lack of a better term, beat the system. We still exercise quite a bit of discretion and very thoughtful underwriting of those transactions. And therefore, I think that to the extent an organization has done their homework, I'm not sure that it provides the strategic advantage, other than to the extent that they're able to acquire capabilities that they don't have today.
Right. And I think that's one of the only primary advantages, is if you acquire the right company that has the right talent on board, then there is a possibility that you're going to hire recent experience, you could say. So buying a company doesn't necessarily circumvent the review process. You might be able to pick up some people if you're picking up the right company. You might be able to pick up some experience, but you're going to go through virtually all the steps. But are there more steps in getting approved with Ginnie Mae as a buyer versus applying, or is it pretty much the same?
It should be a consistent expectation of the amount of work as well as the timeline. You know, I think both of them, given our, at the moment, dearth of applicants, we shouldn't have really a disparate timeline for the consideration of either of those options.
So if someone does know of a company out there that they could acquire, they're going to have expense acquiring it, or they could go through the same process and apply. That's kind of what I had understood. I've actually thought at times and advised that there are sometimes more that you go through than in buying a company, because there's other steps that are involved with the change of control. But that's encouraging to hear. One of the things you mentioned was John Robbins, who's one of my dear friends. I did an interview of him for the Lincoln on Leadership podcast, and I also had the honor of working with him on when he was a part of a company and getting approved, probably in the last 5 to 8 years or so is what I guess, based on time goes fast. But it's so important to have the right staff and the right amount of experience. This was such a good example to me because John is so well known to you. You used to work for him. You, like you said, it's one of your favorite jobs. I have so much respect for John and that experience. Talk about when you're looking at experience. How recent does it have to be? When the case of John, he was well known to you. How much does that influence and might offset other weaker aspects of the package?
Well, the key there was that despite my affection for John, he wasn't the deciding factor. Certainly the breadth of the folks that he had brought on board as a collective team had, you know, close to 25 years of experience in the secondary market, as well as, you know, broad experience of managing, you know, Fannie, Freddie, and Ginnie portfolios from a servicing standpoint, as well as understood, you know, the secondary market implications of delivering into a Ginnie Mae TBA. So John had actually assembled and it had invested in a deeper bench, and that is really what was able to allow us to move forward with that change of control. You know, it's not always the case that if sometimes you may have a strong leader or even someone who has exceptional skills, but if they haven't surrounded themselves with the right level of talent, there is the possibility that they won't be successful in their acquisition.
That is such a good point. I think a lot of people say, well, this person was, you know, a major name in the industry at one point. They're coming back in and we're using their name and we're hoping to get approved with Ginnie Mae. The key to that application and the key to any application, whether the leaders are known to you or not, is the people that they surround themselves. So let's dive into that a bit. One of the things you and I have talked about is you like to see someone with recent Ginnie Mae experience. How recent, and are we finding a challenge in the industry to find people that are so few people that are really approved with Ginnie Mae? Was it 400 some companies, if I recall correctly? Is that a right correct number?
That's about right, yeah.
Yeah, somewhere around that number. Anyway, that's why I thought I looked up. But knowing that we have that small a group of talent to pull from, those people could be hard to get and find. Talk about what are you looking for when it comes to experienced individuals?
A lot of folks have assumed that we're very focused on the recentness of the experience, probably less so on the recentness, but more so on the diversity of that experience. To give you an example, in servicing oversight, for example, some folks have provided resumes of people that have done investor reporting for 5 years, but that's the extent of their experience in servicing. As you might expect, you know, we have the desire that folks that are managing this risk understand all the operational elements from investor reporting to repurchases to default management, and that they have the ability to either provide those services themselves, or if they're using a subservicer, provide rigorous and meaningful oversight of their service provider.
So, and when it comes to be service provider, we're talking oftentimes one a subservicer. And how do you view subservicers? Is that viewed negatively, neutrally within Ginnie Mae?
Well, we think that subservicing is a great opportunity to create economies of scale for smaller issuers, as well as to the extent that issuers have identified where their core strengths are, they've decided that servicing may not be where they want to make their investments. So I don't think there's a downside to subservicing, of course. But what we do expect, though, is that the issuer does understand that they're accountable for the servicing of the asset. If something goes wrong, Ginnie Mae is not going to call your subservicer. We're going to call you, and we expect that you will solve that problem for us. So you need to make sure that you have the ability to meet those expectations and meet that guidelines of our program.
Let's talk a little bit about the process. I want to get on to the existing issuers that are out there, those that are approved already with the company, what we can anticipate. And we're going to go to your slide deck here in just a minute that you used at the Ginnie Mae 2020 Summit. But let's go through the process. Someone applying for Ginnie Mae, if you could kind of walk us through what is the process and what are the time frames someone can expect. And that's assuming we have a clean package that's coming into you.
Yeah, I mean, I think you started off on the right foot. Oftentimes we receive an application package that is either incomplete or where it may meet the form, it hasn't met the substance. And so, you know, there's oftentimes a lot of iteration that goes on getting the applicant to complete the package as required. But once we receive it, there is, at the moment, a fairly short list of applicants. And so it is oftentimes able to be considered, you know, within a couple of weeks of receiving a full package. And then, you know, it does go through a multiple sign-off process that includes myself, as well as some of my colleagues that work in our Office of Issuer and Portfolio Management, where the application is also kind of reviewed for appropriateness as a new entrant to the program.
Well, and that whole overall process, what's a reasonable expectation? Again, assuming the package is complete and meeting the proper requirements, any time frames that you can generally give? I know that can change dramatically by how many people are applying and going through the system, but generally speaking, what are your goals and objectives?
I think that a reasonable expectation is 2 to 3 months at the moment.
Yeah, good. Yeah, we've known that those periods have gotten elongated at different times where you were insanely number of people are applying. Greg, you recently had the Ginnie Mae 2020 Summit, and you did a great job of presenting a number of interesting facts there in a slide deck, and I've been privileged to look at that, and I want to get into that. First of all, I want to get to the part of the slide deck where you talked about a paradigm shift. If you'd share with our listeners, what is the paradigm shift that you're seeing going on right now?
Yeah, you know, if you look back at the history of Ginnie Mae, prior to my arrival, it had always had a rich history of counterparty risk management. Unfortunately, much of the focus had been based on compliance and meeting the minimum expectations of the MBS guide. What we've done is we said, look, it's not just compliance. It's also looking at it from a risk-based perspective. But some of the other things that we're really looking to change in our risk management paradigm is a lot more transparency with our issuers, a lot more, you know, insight into the things they were thinking about, give them opportunities to understand where our concerns may lie. We're very focused on ensuring that we don't run out and implement requirements that violate the mistake of creating one-size-fits-all requirements. And certainly, we want to make sure that we're very targeted in our efforts to improve the risk profile. You know, we obviously want to balance risk-taking for the government, at the same time ensuring that we have a program that adequately attracts capital, attracts participation, and ensures that the Ginnie Mae ecosystem continues to thrive.
Well, let's talk about some of the various risk factors. And in this slide deck and in your presentation, you talked about performance-focused risk, and you talked about issuer risk grades. Could you talk about that as well as the potential future exposure?
So in that particular presentation, I had, you know, kind of a bifurcation between things we do with all issuers, irrespective mm-hmm. of whether we think they're risky or not, and then things that we do for issuers that may require elevated kind of monitoring and assessment. When we look at what we do for all issuers, some of the things that we do that are performance-based is we create an issuer risk grade for each and every one of our issuers. This is a framework that takes advantage of either publicly available ratings to the extent that our issuers are rated, or alternatively, we have a couple of methods to create synthetic ratings. And so for the mortgage bankers, we have created a statistical rating agency equivalent for our non-banks that allow us to understand the relative probability of default for those issuers. Similarly, we've created a stochastic model that models out the issuer's portfolio and understands under a stressed environment, and it models out the potential either positive or negative cash flows from a portfolio that allows us to do two things. One, it allows us to evaluate the impact on our issuer, and it's an input into what the potential risk they might be facing is, as well as it allows us to understand what kind of exposure we might have to the extent that the issuer ultimately defaults. In this category of performance-focused reviews, we also have our issuer operational profile, which is a web-based self-service tool that issuers can use that is really a scorecard across a broad array of metrics that lets an issuer know how they're performing relative to their peers, or alternatively, how they're performing established benchmarks. Then we also do a handful of compliance-focused activities, compliance with various thresholds we might have, like delinquencies, insurance matching, net worth, and liquidity. We have compliance with the requirements under the Fidelity and E&O insurance policies. And lastly, we do have our on-site compliance reviews, which allow us to assess the issuer's compliance with our guide.
Greg, you talked about elevated risk. What are some of the factors that invoke a status of elevated risk?
There's obviously some elevated assessment that is done on our issuers that might be driven by their size or the level of complexity of their organization. The way we might handle some of those would be targeted on-site reviews, could include, you know, monthly or quarterly what we call spotlight calls. And lastly, there's been much written in the press about some meetings we held with our largest non-banks that have been dubbed the issuer liquidity meetings. But essentially, these were meetings that allowed us to talk to the issuers, understand their strategies, understand their mitigating plans, you know, to the extent that we had a turn to an adverse economic environment. Then there's, you know, elevated, you know, kind of monitoring and management that's due to relative performance. Issuers might become, you know, on the watch list. We do have enhanced monitoring plans. Issuers may have received a notice of violation. We may have invoked a unilateral requirement for additional financials. And lastly, there could be issuers that, for lack of a better term, is really a pre-default status.
Right. Of all these particular performance-driven metrics, what is the one that seems to show up the most often or shows up in your desk while an issuer is on the watch list?
Well, maybe it's worthwhile for us to go ahead and talk a little bit about what the watch list is. So the watch list is a tool that allows us to prioritize our resources as well as ensure that we're applying the requisite level of oversight to our issuers. The three categories of the watch list include those that have potentially scored poorly on our issuer risk grade process. Their synthetic risk grades suggest that they have a higher probability of default. The second category is related to those that may have violated one of our compliance requirements. They may have elevated delinquencies. They may have an unsatisfactory level of loans that are properly insured, and they may have violated some of our financial requirements. And then the last category is what we call a discretionary category. Oftentimes we'll include issuers that perhaps are facing regulatory challenges or alternatively may be over-risking relative to their infrastructure and financial capabilities. And so really the way we use it is that we work with issuers to resolve these challenges. It becomes a way to have that dialogue and understand what their strategies are to remedy the situation. It is certainly factored into decisions we make on commitment authority, the willingness for us to enter into an acknowledgement agreement, and lastly, to the extent that there is a servicing transfer contemplated, it is certainly part of the assessment and the analysis we go through. And, you know, the last point I would make is we certainly don't want a situation where issuers are perpetually, you know, on the watch list. Our expectation is that issuers are going through levels of remediation and could see a day when they are removed from the watch list.
Yeah, I know you want everyone included as much as possible. I'm impressed with what extent you go to keeping people in the program, and I applaud you for that. I want to go to what you had in your presentation as the two similar issuer profiles. This was like a case study, almost like running down two parallel paths. If you could, as best you can, not describe the slides you had, or as best you can, Greg, explain the various factors that go into how two issuers with similar profiles can differ so much.
Yeah, I think that from that presentation, you start to see that issuers, based on their strategies, might be changing their risk profile in a dramatic way. For example, you know, two issuers have the same size portfolio and ostensibly they have the same requirements in our program. But what you can see is that some of them may be being aggressive in how they record their MSR multiples. You might see that they have gone further down the credit curve, and that is manifesting itself in higher levels of delinquency. You might see that one of those companies has been more aggressive in leveraging the company and taking out debt. And the way that ends up potentially showing itself is that you could have situations where $2 billion portfolios could look very different. You might have one, for example, that has been more aggressive in pricing the MSR and therefore has locked in a lower potential inflow of cash. They might have been more aggressive in the multiple that they recorded at. To the extent that they've been more aggressive in their credit profile, they may find themselves with higher levels of delinquencies. And then again, if you see somebody that's taken on more debt, you know, secured debt to total assets starts becoming, in my mind, one of the great predictors of, you know, an issuer's ability to manage when the environment turns negative. And then, you know, that has, you know, some financial ratios that come along with that. You know, MSRs to total equity becomes disproportionate, and what you find is volatility related to capital becomes much more amplified because of that. And then, you know, again, some of the metrics that might suggest adequate cash flows coming from servicing fees start to be diminished depending on how much delinquency the issuer is experiencing.
When you were talking about some of the ratios, if you could get a little more specific on what are some of the ratios that you guys use at Fannie Mae in evaluating someone that might be on the watch list versus someone that's in good standing?
Well, for example, the issuer risk grade model, which is in the process of being revamped. We're doing a lot of back testing at the moment on a new version. But the existing model, you know, really focuses on, you know, the four big elements of the CAMELS process. We leave out management, but we focus on capital adequacy, asset quality, earnings, and liquidity. And some of the notable items underneath, you know, those categories might include in the capital adequacy space, MSR to tangible net worth. In the asset quality, they could be MSR to total assets. In earnings, it could be pre-tax operating margin. And notably in the liquidity, we might look at secured debt to total assets. All of these are combined to arrive at a final risk grade. And there are other elements, but for brevity, I've just given you a smattering of those. And the idea would be to understand how those, you know, combine to suggest, you know, the strength of the entity.
Greg, we've covered a lot of ground already, and there's so much more that we could cover. But what have we not talked about that you would like anyone considering being a part of the program that, or that is a part of the program to know?
Yeah, I think that the thing that I would suggest is we've enjoyed a 10-year stretch of pretty bucolic performance in the mortgage space. Issuers have made money through the cycle, and they have enjoyed the benefits of a very low interest rate environment. What I would ask all of them to do is to continue to be vigilant in thinking about how they would manage should the environment not be as ideal as it is, you know, over the last 10 years. I think the COVID-19 pandemic has introduced some of those topics to some of our issuers. Issuers that may have not been in business during the last recession, and I think they're understanding why we have been fairly aggressive in suggesting that issuers need to be making contingency plans given the environment that we could face in the future. And again, some of those are coming to roost as we speak, so issuers really would be well served by thinking about how do they develop a matrixed, you know, kind of liability stack? How do they layer out, you know, the maturity dates of their facilities, ensuring that they don't borrow the maximum allowable under some of their facilities in order to avoid some of the margin calls that may occur? And some of those lessons learned that some of our issuers have faced over the last 2 months I think are worthwhile for all of our issuers to bear in mind.
Greg, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Appreciate you being here. Our guest has been Greg Keith, Senior Vice President, Chief Risk Officer of Jenny May, and we're going to invite him back because there's a lot more we could get into, especially as we watch the current events unfold. We'll be getting more information and diving deeper in some of these aspects. Greg, thanks so much for being here with us.
My pleasure, David. Thanks for having me.
Really enjoyed doing that interview. Lots of good information. Share this podcast with anyone that you know that's trying to get approved with Jenny May. But by the way, a lot of things you talked about also true for Fannie and Freddie getting approved. There's new requirements. I don't know if it's so much new requirements as much as heightened attention to details of how you're running your business. And I encourage you to go back and listen to this again. I really appreciate Greg Keith coming on and willing to come on and be a part of the podcast today. I want to say a special thank you to those who are working hard, keeping their companies up to speed and performing in excellence. You need to be congratulated on that. If you're not feeling like you are up to that level or wondering if you're up to that level, please get a hold of myself and Mark Helm, who works with me on the advisory side, does a great job, and we'd love to work with you. Also, Andy Schell, all of us, a part of the podcast, are here for you, and we would love to be a resource to you. I encourage you to check out the website, AinsworthAdvisors.com. It is an advisory board, and we have some top professionals on it. We're expanding that list pretty rapidly and aggressively because we've had such a demand recently for services. So good to have you with us, everybody. I want to say a special thank you to our sponsors. Look at our sponsor page, all of our sponsors. But I want to call a special attention out to Finastra. Say thank you to them, as well as Indicom and Celerate, Ainsworth Advisor. I already talked about them. And just so grateful for all of the sponsors that are here with us. A great week, everybody. Look forward to having you back here next week.
You've been listening to Licken on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update with your host, David Licken of Transformational Mortgage Solutions. Join us next week, and thanks for listening.